This city, I'll call her Lanaichie, or Flaxflower Blue. It has been raining persistently here for almost a month, though I arrived little more than a week ago. My live-in landlord has marked each rainy day with a lime green teardrop on the kitchen calendar, just an outline in the right-hand corner of the day square with a gel pen. She hasn't coloured them in. 29 lime green teardrops to match the lime green toaster and kettle. On the inside of my bedroom window, there are speckles of black mould and shame. I haven't yet attempted to wipe either off. Lanaichie is quieter and more sparse than the other cities I've recently inhabited, and this morning I saw a brown sodden sock stamped into the pavement between the train station and laundrette. This city, this Flaxflower Blue, this landscape by the sea is where I will forget, where I will create a new life. And today is the beginning. Today and thereafter, my name is Lim. So let me start here. Lanaichie is on the pale blue end of the spectrum, rather than the scarlet. These flowers are soft, multitudinous, five semi-transparent petals apiece. Terminal clusters of trombone flares, and once fully unfurled, sepal shadows appear. The shadows are indistinct and muted, a comforting distance that doesn't threaten my personal space, of which I am now ferociously defensive. I walk quickly along her deep purple veins, parallel streets that lead down to the stony beach. Up and down, there's moss and lichen on my front steps and the sea is always there, to my right, to my left, migi, hirari. I look behind my shoulder and her sky blue pollen tips prickle in the sea spray. This is a windy city and my hair is all over the place. Strands stuck to my face by the intermittent drizzle. Umbrellas are useless. I've broken two already. A hood then, but still my books and notepads are wet. I carry them in my backpack everywhere and they have witnessed each place that I have. Broken spines, annotations, page edges now damp and curling with the thousands of miles that I have travelled. Like an appendage to my body, I feel their weight as an extra limb or set of fingers, or even a pair of wings. I'm imprinting these streets as new cognitive pathways, associating them with a vast palette of colours and textures, subconscious methods of navigation, of reading the landscape. I live on one side of the city, now walking towards the other. Western Road, then onto North Street, and like every other British high street, the pavements are stained with grease, and the pungent aroma of vinegar and watered-down ketchup hits me. Instantly nauseous, I cover my mouth and nose with my scarf. Beyond the city centre and up a hill, I look down side streets at offshoot alleyways. Yoga studios, hairdressers, local pubs nestled amongst terraced houses in painted powder yellow, turquoise, cherry red, lilac, royal blue. At the top of the hill, I look back over the city, and once again, as if I hadn't ever seen it, I discover the sea. I turn in the direction that I came, towards the palest blue section of the city, so pale it's almost alabaster. Pass through the cloud of grease and vinegar and ketchup, then back onto Western Road. Placed at each intersection, as a declaration of the city's eco-credentials, are large communal rubbish and recycling bins, though I discover that the variety of plastic the local council accepts is limited to bottles. The remaining abundance of packaging goes to landfill. Beside Palmyra Square, I watch the local flower seller assist an elderly person across the road. Then he returns to his stall and offers me a bunch of fuchsia pink lilies for £10. I decline. The city is floral enough for me. Things that are also Flaxflower Blue, or close to it. The month of June, which sits to the left of the bright and dazzling yellow May, whose days bulge with rounded edges and soft almond eyes. I have a summer dress this colour. I don't wear it often, and in fact, I don't know why I still have it. It skims over my stomach, making me tighten and hold my breath, and there's no pockets for my personal effects. The dress is flowing, but in it I am constricted. Instead, I prefer to wear tight jeans and large t-shirts or jumpers and solid boots. My mum once painted her bedroom walls this colour. Now I have made the connection, I feel less comfortable about living here. I can feel the cold plaster on my cheek and palm before it was painted. There was a paper border just below the picture rail. Some printed flower I cannot exactly remember which. Perhaps daisies. Though my mum was not a daisy sort of person. More like chrysanthemum and pine. Perhaps my dad had painted the indistinct flowers. There were yellow and white petals, that I am certain. I can clearly hear the closing drawers of the dresser, feel the crisp cotton bed sheets and smell the vintage must of my mum's collection of kimonos she kept folded under the bed. The number two. In the British Cyclopedia of Natural History, Volume 2, 1857, Charles Frederick Partington notes, "Flaxflower blue, Berlin blue with a slight tinge of ultramarine blue. Animal, light parts of the margin of the wings of devil's butterfly. Vegetable, flaxflower, mineral, blue copper ore." Lavender and flaxflower blue are quite similar, though for me they occupy quite different locations in my mind's eye, my synesthetic subspace as I call it. Flaxflower to the bottom right and close by, lavender top left and in the distance. I have a lavender head in my coat pocket that I pick from a neighbour's front garden and finger it relentlessly, fiddling and sliding my thumbnail into the tiny individual buds as I walk along the streets, exploring. My fiddling is violent, a tiny act of aggression born from excess cortisol coursing through my body, each surge reminding me of my vulnerability. But the scent is what I'm after, sifting up through my clothes and softening my hunched shoulders. I'll pick another head off tomorrow, after I've fingered this one to dust. Lanaichier's flowers are ephemeral, fleeting, lasting only a single day, perhaps a reflection of my erratic mood and lifetime of incessant peregrinations. Her lancelot leaves are slender, hairless, greyish-green and abundant. Flax flowers, I have read, attract bees, and for them the nectar yield is high. From May to September, thrumming honeybees waggle dance and pollinate from sunrise until 1 in the afternoon, nudging pollen down into their pockets. I have not seen a honeybee here yet, just a couple of bumbles. I am out of season. In my new house's small conservatory, I have planted seeds of bee-attracting plants with hopes that next year we will be frequented by many pollinators. Will I still be here when they finally bloom? The house is cold and damp. I have not learned how to work the thermostat, and anyway, Anchor, my landlord, objects to the use of excess central heating. A minuscule mushroom is all I have managed to propagate. So I have a home, an anchor, a fixed point of departure that I can return to, which is almost a novelty. But I'm flighty. I might change my mind at any time and decide to leave. My new room is rented by the month, after all. I am unaccustomed to security, to certainty, to my location being moored in a single place. My plans, though enthusiastically fixed and compelling at the outset, often change in an instant, and all that I was so certain of melts away. I am inconsistent. After 10 years of transience and impermanence, of suitcase living and sleeplessness in colleagues' spare rooms and sofas, hostels, park benches, train stations, night buses, once a tabletop in a tiny Bangkok noodle bar, I have a home, I have a home, I have a semi-stable home, my new mantra. I'll repeat it as a reminder that stability can be constructive. And I chew on it, the slender veined leaves of being rooted in one place for an undetermined period of time. I emigrated from this country almost 12 years ago, and its rhythm is at once both acutely familiar and entirely foreign. I am at a loss as to how I should interact with it, which direction I should point myself in. Before here, I was in Tokyo, midnight blue powdered with gold dust, an overloaded megalopolis, sprawling skyward and out. There I felt compact and anonymous, insignificant, free to roam. But I left abruptly a month ago, an impulse decision to quit my job and catch a flight back here. My most prolific project abandoned, months of work wasted, 10 years of learning and mastering my craft in hundreds of diverse urban landscapes, tracing a city's synesthetic arteries, perennial cartographic renovations, recording, recoding, redefining, mapping neurodivergent experiences of space for the archive of perceptual otherness. Invariably on foot, always with a backpack containing my dictaphone, cartographic books, sketchbook, pencils and pens. But now I am here and all of that is of no significance. I am here to forget, to rebuild, to put my synesthetic perception to an alternative use. Or perhaps, to no use at all. My new bedroom is roughly 10 metres by 7 metres, and has in it a desk with a couple of books, a lamp, and a small spider plant. One bright orange folding metal chair, a single bed with bedsheets that belong to the house and have on them printed palm leaves in overlaid tropical greens and lime, muted with the overuse of countless bodies of previous occupants. A pair of brown velvet curtains that are worn in places, almost notably at the edges. One window that looks out onto a narrow alleyway and is lit at night by a street lamp. A wardrobe with a limited collection of clothes. I don't need much. The wardrobe fits my suitcase perfectly, in which I keep my old synesthetic cartography equipment. Redundant equipment. I don't know why I've kept it either. Other than a laptop, phone and wallet, I have no other possessions. It's dark outside, and through the irregular gap between the curtains, The streetlight etches itself onto my bedroom wall. I sit at the desk, flick through the illustrated world of Encyclopedia of Insects, a natural history and identification guide to beetles, flies, bees, wasps, springtails, maleflies, stoneflies, dragonflies, damselflies, cockroaches, mantids, earwigs, and many more. An edition that features several of my dad's scientific illustrations. I know the pages by heart, so I turn to a familiar damselfly and touch the delineations of body and wing. Then, I'm both in my new bedroom and back in my dad's old workroom. Suddenly his desk overlays mine. On his lays an open sketchbook with damselfly studies. The wings are too fragile for the weight of my childlike fingertips, my adult fingertips. I've been careless, reckless, smudged the meticulously rendered veins, and he'll be furious when he comes home. Then I'm out in the garden, kicking my feet through piles of leaves in shades of saffron, russet, burnt ochre and gold, xanthophylls and bitter carotene. I look back at the house. I can see my mum watching me from the kitchen window. I look down at my feet and the leaves then turn to mulch, decomposition and decay. It has been 5 years since he died and I wonder if his bones, without the flesh, still look like him. A curlicue wisp of pewter was the last I saw of my dad. He slipped beneath the silent tracks of ants, millipedes, earwigs, crawling. I close the encyclopedia. It's past midnight and raining outside. This room smells of damp. The walls are paper-like. House sounds violate my already volatile personal space. Downstairs in the lounge, Anka talks loudly on her phone. She lets her two cats sleep in the kitchen sink and likes the colour lime green. She wears it often, which is incongruent to me, as in my person-to-colour synesthesia, she is resolutely silver. Left at the junction, I hear her say. I lay my head and arms on the encyclopedia, listen to the pattering rain. Some hours pass. I haven't yet slept. I've been inert, in paralysis. The heavy weight of a spectral figure above me, crushing my breath and reminding me what I've run away from. He's heavy, oppressive, and though my eyes are covered by his sweaty hands, I can see each repulsive pore, each eyebrow and beard hair, each of his sapphire blue atoms, of which there are over 7 billion billion billion. So I close myself down, compact origami folds that might splinter like broken glass if I move. The rain has cleared, and so I open the curtains. Morning sunlight ripples over my untouched bed. The old and familiar bodily urge to flee is persistent, and I'm out walking again. I go to the lanes, which are always busy with people and their associative colours, even at this time of the morning. It's not that I want to interact with anyone, but loneliness can be glacial. I look at the lettering and numerals of shops and cafes and street names instead. Namel, duck egg blue, bright yellow, pewter, sunset orange, grey. Resident Records, red, 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 garnet, rose, ruby, persistent flicker of white, always oppressive, omnipotent. Ship Street, more red, fuchsia, navy, maroon, bright and chipper, bright red, cheeky, crispy gold. Ordinarily, I feel grounded by these colours and their reliability, their unshifting nature. But recently, it's begun to feel overwhelming, all that cross-sensory information happening simultaneously. I go to Cafe Coho on Ship Street, and at the counter, I'm served by a person with purple, forest green colour associations, and it's all I can see. A cloud split in two, purple to the left, forest green to the right. I focus on the server's outline amidst the fog, order black coffee and an almond croissant that looks sickly sweet. I turn away from the counter and the cloud instantly disperses. I sit outside so I can sketch the geometrical shapes of the building's roofs against the mottled grey sky. Colours float around me as though carried through the air by multicoloured atoms, inscribed on the sky like a script. With each bite and sip, I concentrate on the scents and textures of almond and strong coffee. It's an act of deep concentration where I can discover sensory respite in scent. Here there are no associations or visuals. I spend the rest of the morning sitting on the beach, watching the waves calmly crest against the shoreline. It's a serene one today. Back home. Is this really home? I open the front door and Anka is in the kitchen, busying. I don't much feel like talking, so I head up the stairs, but she's heard me and comes out. Lim, she shouts, then lowers her voice and says, one of your seedlings has begun to sprout and something came through the post for you today. She half smiles and passes me an A4-sized parcel, about 2 inches thick. I thank her and go upstairs, put my backpack on the floor and sit at the desk with the lamp switched on. The parcel has a Japan postmark, dated from just over a week ago. My mouth feels dry, palms moist. I slide my finger underneath the envelope sealed down flap and tear it open. Inside, several of my synesthetic maps of Tokyo, a single sachet of green tea, a new synesthetic cartographer's ruler, and a pen. A typed note that reads, "Dear friend, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo, I long for Kyoto. Basho." Now, does this entice you? The feminist takeover of perceptual otherness. In Kyoto for 6 more months, and then? Fude. Fude Yamaguchi, pronounced Fude. 2 syllables. Is a close friend and ex-colleague in Tokyo. My colour for her is parakeet green, which she hates. She is a sound-colour synesthetic cartographer and a drummer in a jazz band. The maps, of which there are 4 in total, are folded neatly from their original A2 size down to A4. I am uncertain as to why Fude has sent the maps to me, and even how she got a hold of them. I thought the early output of this project had been filed under irrelevant after I had left so suddenly, as per the archive's regulations. Perhaps she has staged some sort of feminist uprising in the Tokyo Perceptual Otherness archive, as she talked so often of doing. Or is she planning one? I reread her accompanying note, uncertain of what she is insinuating. With the maps unseen and back in the envelope, I put them inside my suitcase and send Fude an email. Fude, got your parcel? Thanks, can't look at the maps yet, too soon. What are you planning? L. X. After a few minutes, Fude replies with, "Just thought you should have them. They are yours, not his or the archives." I'm still trying to take him down, much resistance from archive, but I'm persisting until he's out for good. No chance he'll be arrested, though. Takeover is new organisational idea to structurally change archive, like my other plans, but more systematic and succinct. Could do with your creative insight and meticulous planning. Come to Kyoto when you feel better. Or I'll be back in Tokyo in 6 months. I've been in contact with a custodian in Mexico City. She's on our side and says she has a group of female cartographers with similar stories and are ready to join our movement. I don't reply. Several weeks pass and the rain peters out into a light mist in the early mornings. 4 out of my 10 seedlings are peeking through the soil in the conservatory and, with Anka's permission, I have given away the brown velvet curtains and replaced them with a flax flower blue pair that I bought from a charity shop on Blatchington Road. Early one morning I follow a queen bumblebee and she leads me to a park nearby my house, nestled in a residential area. It is spring and the air is intoxicating. Scent wisps tickle my nostrils and I feel lifted, separate from my past self. I surmise that the queen bumble must be in search of either pollen energy after her long period of underground winter hibernation, or perhaps she is looking for a new nest. I watch her hover around a lavender bush and wonder how much pollen she has already collected this morning. Then I write thoughts for a possible bee-related walk in one of my notebooks. For a week or so now, I have been working as a studio assistant at an arts cooperative called ArtSpace. My daily tasks are fairly menial, but I relish the distraction and opportunity to be surrounded by artists and craftspeople. A guy called George rents out a desk there. He's from New Zealand and his associative colour is burgundy. He makes a point of coming to talk to me regularly throughout the day, which I find contradictorily stifling and engaging. Some things I've learned about George. He is a lecturer in theories of synesthetic cartography at the University of Auckland, but is on sabbatical and has decided to spend several months here, conducting field work on sequence-based synesthetic cartography. He knows that I am also a synesthete and that I am aware of the archive's work, but I have not divulged that until quite recently I was also a synesthetic cartographer. Any mention of synesthesia invariably leads to conversations in which he meticulously details the practice of synesthetic cartography and the archive's aims. I let him mansplain without interruption. Yesterday he asked if I would like to accompany him on a synesthetic walk sometime so that I might learn, from him, how to read the urban landscape as a synesthetic cartographer does. "No thank you," I said, retreating to the back storeroom. After that, he left me alone. Loneliness is glacial, and I am a polar bear. At another desk work an artistic duo. Their names are Alex, cherry red, and Charlie, sunflower yellow. They are graphic novel artists, currently working on a story set in this city, which follows a teenage girl who has recently moved here from another country and struggles to leave her traumatic past behind. The girl has special abilities, or superpowers, that allow her to sense the world with a remarkably high acuity. However, having such an enriched sensory capacity her abilities make her vulnerable to intense traumatic flashbacks. When Alex and Charlie explained the plot to me, I asked what the girl used her abilities for, and they replied that she hadn't yet discovered her true calling and was unlikely to until the end of the second volume. This was her character arc, one of self-discovery and self-mastery. Today is Saturday, and in a few hours I will be leading a life drawing workshop, my first at Artspace. I'm not required to teach, just facilitate the session and then tidy the studio afterwards. I wake up whilst it's still dark outside, nervous and on edge. More sapphire blue nightmares, so I go down to the seafront to watch the sunrise over the pier. I sit down on the stony beach. The tide is out this morning and the waves drag along the pebbles, revealing the sandy bed. The sun slowly creeps up, visible by the pink and orange hues it casts onto the water, which quickly turns into iridescent cerulean blue. Behind me, joggers line the promenade. One swimmer braces the cold waves. I look over to the pier and see a starling murmuration. They're like fingertips dipped in ink and wiped rapidly across a page. The image shifts, mutates and undulates across the sky. Then they're off. The life drawing class passes by without anything of interest happening. 15 attendees, including George, Alex and Charlie, all in front of easels, sketchbooks or boards propped up against tables with taped on sheets of paper. The room smells like charcoal and pastel and terps, the dry air of a fan heater. The model starts the session with several 5-minute poses, then goes on to a couple of longer 40-minute poses, with a break between. I sit at the back of the room reading Breasts and Eggs by Meiko Kawakami, periodically responding to a request for more paper, pencils, erasers. At the end of the class, I tidy the equipment away, and whilst I'm doing so, George approaches me. He says, "I didn't draw the model, I drew you." He hands me an A3 piece of paper, and his burgundy colour floods my synesthetic subspace, weighty and oppressive. The drawing is proficient and finely detailed. I am pictured in my seated position at the back of the room among the stacks of canvases and easels, book in hand. A transient and vulnerable moment immortalised. He has drawn me with higher cheekbones than I have in reality, a fuller bust, thinner legs, more elegant fingers. I don't know what to do with this drawing, with this seemingly insignificant act of violation and invalidation, and the burgundy is becoming too much for me to bear. I flick my thumbnail back and forth over the edge of the paper, creating a tiny tear. "Don't you like it?" George asks. I hand the drawing back to George without a word, not even a look of admiration or recognition or gratitude, which I expect he expects. He folds the drawing up like origami, then leaves me to finish tidying up. Back at home, the cats have followed me upstairs and curled themselves around each other at the foot of the bed. I take Fido's envelope out of my suitcase and remove the 4 synesthetic maps. Each are printed on off-white fine-grained cartridge paper with a weight of 160 GSM, standard archive practice. I don't altogether know if I'm ready to look at them closely, and I realise how the midnight blue and gold of Tokyo complements this city's flaxflower blue. I think of the queen bumblebee I saw several weeks ago and lay on the bed on my side, next to the cats. I've never had a pet, so this is uncharted territory, but they're both purring and I let them nestle themselves against my stomach. I feel tense at first, distracted, but then my breathing feels more fluid, less restricted. I am still a polar bear, and although my fur is translucent, I feel softer, somehow more prepared. After a time, I get up and unfold one of the maps. In the top right corner, Ueno, Taitoku, Tokyo, Grapheme, Personality, Colour. See here. When I made this map, the project's first, I had only been in Tokyo for a couple of weeks and was still experiencing what the archive terms synesthetic lexical colour dissonance. Though I was familiar with the 3 Japanese alphabets and already had weak colour associations with several of the characters, I was struggling to navigate myself around Tokyo as the associative colours of the street names, depicted in both English and Japanese, were conflicting with one another. Daily I felt discombobulated and lost, so I asked the archive to allocate a partner to assist me in mapping out the next area to which I had been assigned. All I needed was someone to navigate the neighbourhood, to help me see the bigger geographical picture. But his personality was too dominant, too self-assured, too toxic to allow a woman to lead, and the project soon became his. The archive didn't much care who the main cartographer was, so long as they got a finished product. I put the map on the floor, then unfold another. See here. I run my finger over a silver, silky smooth area, and it pulses as if charged. Electric reminders. I think about the moment I drew it, we drew it, him and I. He is sapphire blue, and he stained my skin, my internal organs, my sacred subspace that no other has access to. He is the heavyweight I'm trying desperately to shift, desperate to erase. Too much. So I refold the maps and put them back in the envelope, close the curtains and get into bed. The cats have gone back downstairs to anchor. I pull the duvet up. The worn fabric feels disgusting against my skin, but I need something. I need something to touch as I try to sleep and block out the feel of him. Concentrate. I have roughly 500 eyelash hairs. I'm counting them again to be certain of the exact amount, to keep my mind occupied. Shadows on the wall, howling outside, a seagull. I slip in and out. Alert, I keep vigil, but my body clock is off kilter and the night shift is over. It's beginning. We're in the midst of mist, a thick glare above the park, the pond, the lawn. It's been raining for weeks, back then and now. I slept on his sofa for one night whilst we worked late in Asakusa. He lived nearby, in a one-room bedroom apartment close to the station, and I heard the rain crash against the pavement outside as I lay with my head on the armrest. I woke up, heavy with sleep but instantly alert. He was standing over me, all of his 7 billion 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 sapphire blue atoms. He lifted the blanket up off my body and looked down, shining a torch. Gold lights danced over my body. "What the fuck are you doing?" I said. "Just looking for something. Go back to sleep," he replied. He bent over and reached his hand down to my stomach, lifted my t-shirt up, and I attempted to push his hand away. I shouted, "Get off of me!" Then, he threw the blanket over the back of the sofa, violent, dropped the torch on the floor. It made a loud but dull thud, and I heard it roll underneath the sofa. Maybe it fell apart and the battery scattered, I don't know. I moved to pick it up, and he pushed me back down. "I haven't found what I wanted yet. Be still," he said. "God damn it, you're a tease." His palm over my mouth, I tried to bite him, but he pushed my head down into the sofa and I was powerless, a green lace wing with wings as fragile as dust. I felt him inching his fingers down, each digit a leaden weight, then his whole body. Beneath him I struggled, and my wings disintegrated, powdery ashes contaminated with sapphire blue. So I sit on the bathroom floor and hold my legs, more origami, the small compact ones you can put into your pocket, not the flamboyant stuff. Some hours pass and it appears that I have cried. Ishil Chebel Yax, the goddess of painting and writing, possibly also the goddess of textiles, kneels down and hugs me. Her face is very appealing and familiar. "Were you here all along?" I ask. "No," she says, "I was making dinner." "Your eyebrows feel nice underneath my fingertips," I say, touching the carved stone recesses of her face. She kisses my forehead and shows me her breasts, which are tattooed with a cuckoo in magenta, turquoise and black. Someone punches her in the stomach. It could have been me, or she could have done it to herself. I'm not altogether certain, and maybe some other body is nearby. Although Ishel Chebel Yax, the goddess of painting and writing, possibly also the goddess of textiles, is made of stone, she's winded and gasping for air, eyes wide and petrified. I get up, from the bathroom floor, from the sapphire blue stained sofa, my single bed, all the beds and spaces I have ever slept in, from the black hole I slipped into. Then I fall back down again. In the morning I send a reply to Fule. Seeing the cuckoo, I long for the parakeet. Kyoto in 2 days. Limp.